From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR correspondents around the globe. I'm Douglas Roberts. This week, the president of Pakistan steps down. The ongoing confrontation between Russia and the former Soviet Republic of Georgia, and the lighter side of the Olympics in Beijing. As the week began, Pakistan's President Pervez Musharraf, a staunch U.S. ally, resigned rather than face impeachment by his political opponents, the new coalition government led by the late Benazir Bhutto's party. Musharraf spent 9 turbulent years in office. His enemies said his departure was a major step forward for democracy. Others weren't so sure. NPR's Philip Reeves was in the capital, Islamabad, and he filed this report.
Musharraf made a defiant exit. He'd acted in good faith, he said. He was leaving to avoid further political confrontation that would have damaged the nation. So what happens to Musharraf now? Some of his opponents want him placed on trial. Before resigning, Musharraf was pressing for an immunity deal. We don't yet know if he got one. Nor do we know if Musharraf will stay in Pakistan, he's building a mansion on the edge of Islamabad, or if he'll go into exile, perhaps in the US or Saudi Arabia. Political commentator and former ambassador to Washington, Tariq Fatemi.
I think he'll leave the country for some time, then see how things develop back home. He's a very stubborn person. I had always said that he would not walk away.
The law says elections for a new president must be held within 30 days. Until then, the chairman of Pakistan's Senate will be acting president. Powers now shifted in Pakistan from the army and the presidency to the prime minister and parliament. We can expect the constitution to be changed to ensure the next president won't be able to dismiss the government. With their mutual enemy, Musharraf, gone, will Pakistan's ruling coalition parties now be able to hold together? Its leaders, Benazir Bhutto's widow Asif Zardari and former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, have had big disagreements. Both men seem eager for power. Their parties have a long record of mutual hostility. Former senior government official Tayyab Siddiqui is not optimistic.
This coalition is not going to last. It has too many contradictions built in. And as we have already seen, there's bound to be a split.
One area of possible friction is whether senior judges sacked by Musharraf will now be restored. This is a key demand of Sharif's and also of the country's legal and civil rights communities. Zardari appears to be less enthusiastic. Analysts say he fears the restored judges may annul an amnesty organised by Musharraf, which allowed him and his wife, the late Benazir Bhutto, to return to Pakistan without fear of facing corruption charges. As Pakistan adjusts to life without Musharraf, the mood seems subdued. This was one of several scattered celebrations in the capital, Islamabad, today, after Musharraf announced his resignation. There were no mass festivities. Pakistanis seem to be reflecting on a general who never learnt how to play politics, a soldier who analysts say saw himself as a canny commando, but sometimes had very little idea of what was going on at ground level.
If anyone says that I've become unpopular, I don't agree with that. I have my own methods of finding out, and I made sure of it.
Fatemi believes, in the end, history will not look particularly kindly on Musharraf, although he says the general's rule started with hope.
His primary constituency, the urban, educated, secular, liberal sections, were the ones who were the most deeply disappointed at the end of 9 years.
Abdul Hafiz Pirzada, lawyer and advisor to Musharraf, thinks the world will soften its view with time.
He has his pluses and his minuses. He has made some good things. He has been good for Pakistan, particularly in the initial years. And he has also committed some mistakes. When the dust settles down, history would be kinder to him than what appears to be the general perception today.
Philip Reeves, NPR News, Islamabad.
As the United States and Europe struggle to deal with Russia's occupation of Georgia, Moscow appears to be thumbing its nose at the West. Despite its promises to withdraw from Georgian territory, Russia's actions on the ground show the Kremlin is doing exactly what it wants, and that may include redrawing the map of Georgia. NPR's Gregory Pfeiffer reports from the Georgian breakaway region of South Ossetia.
In the devastated South Ossetian capital, Skhinvali, a residential neighborhood of small two-story houses has been reduced to piles of rubble. Izolda Kutieva's home was hit by shelling during ferocious street fighting. She says Russia has to control South Ossetia to ensure that never happens again.
We've been part of Russia since the 18th century. It was only under the Soviet Union that Ossetia was split and South Ossetia was given to Georgia. This is the land of our ancestors, and the Georgians have no claim to it.
Skhinvali will take a long time to rebuild, but the Russian Emergency Corps of Engineers is already putting up scaffolding around hospitals, schools, and other bullet-ridden buildings. Russia has supported this isolated, impoverished region since it broke away from Georgia in the early 1990s. After Tbilisi tried to retake control earlier this month, Moscow responded with overwhelming force, destroying the Georgian military and occupying much of Georgia. In Skhinvali, as in the rest of South Ossetia, there are Russian military trucks, tanks, and soldiers everywhere. The Russians are in charge here, and Ilyanyura Bidoeva, deputy head of the South Ossetian government, says that's just what the South Ossetians want.
We want to be recognized as an independent republic as soon as possible, and then we'll join Russia. This land has never been part of Georgia.
Russia's foreign minister has said Georgia can forget about any intention to get South Ossetia back, even though the ceasefire Moscow signed with Tbilisi says both sides must withdraw their forces to positions they held before the conflict began, and that the region's status will be decided in future negotiations. Russia says Georgia has no right to rule South Ossetia because it attempted to carry out genocide against the South Ossetians. But Tbilisi has long accused Moscow of wanting to annex South Ossetia. Georgian President Mikhail Saakashvili.
The goal of this operation is not only to seize and annex parts of Georgian territory, but they clearly said that the goal of this operation is the change of democratically elected government of Georgia.
Russia's humiliating occupation of large swaths of Georgian territory and reports of wide-scale looting by Russian troops appear aimed at dismantling Georgia's infrastructure, strangling its economy, and paralyzing its government. And Moscow says even after its troops withdraw from positions deep inside the country, Russian forces will remain indefinitely in buffer zones around South Ossetia and another breakaway region, Abkhazia. Some believe that means Moscow plans to keep that territory in Georgia proper for itself. 40 miles from Skhinvali, the occupied Georgian city of Gori is half deserted. Residents are nervous, but many are still defiant. Ariel Kasradze says Georgia will never give up Abkhazia and South Ossetia. That's out of the question, he says. Russia is only using the conflicts in those regions to take Georgia's territory. But we'll always remain free, he says. Asked what makes him sure, he replies, the West will help us. Gregory Pfeiffer, NPR News, Skhinvali, South Ossetia.
The Kremlin is unapologetic about its actions in Georgia. Officials have repeatedly, forcefully, and sometimes emotionally insisted that Russia has the right to protect its soldiers and those it calls citizens. In the West, Russia's actions have spurred concerns about a resurgent muscle-flexing Russia. Newspaper cartoons depict a snarling bear, an image not seen since Soviet times. As NPR's Anne Garrels reports from Moscow on a vastly more confident Russia that feels slighted by the West.
15 years ago, after the Soviet Union fell apart, scientists were forced to work as taxi drivers. Soldiers were reduced to rags. The standard of living never great plummeted. Viktor Kremenyuk with the USA Canada Institute says everything Russians were used to suddenly disappeared.
It has lost empire. The empire was for many people, the major sense of their existence. Now it's no more.
But Russia is no longer on its knees. It's developing a new identity. While Kremenyuk does not endorse Russia's actions in Georgia, he says Vladimir Putin's harsh words in recent years have reflected widespread and growing frustration.
It was regarded as poor, retarded, underdeveloped, and so on. And now under Mr. Putin, Russia has finally emerged as a more or less well-to-do nation. But it wanted to have the feeling that now it will be regarded by the other nations differently, with more respect.
Rose Gottmuller at Moscow's Carnegie Center says the Bush administration didn't adequately respond to Russian concerns.
Washington has been neglecting the relationship with Russia profoundly over the last 8 years. We've had a situation time and time again when President Bush has gone to a summit meeting, you know, declared his cooperation with his good friend President Putin, and then he's gone back to Washington and nothing has happened.
Some in the Bush administration argue Russia is simply unwilling to acknowledge the post-Soviet realities. Nikolai Zlobin, a Russian analyst with the Washington-based World Security Institute, says it's the West which is also inflexible.
Why? For 15 years after the end of Cold War, West did do very little to make Russia an ally and friend. Every Russian leader came to power saying reasonable things about the West, and sooner or later something happened which will turn them into anti-American.
Slobin doesn't pretend the new Russia is easy to deal with. At home in Russia for a brief visit, he's stunned at the growth of nationalism and anti-American feeling.
I talk to my friends who are friends with Americans. They basically say America is an extremely selfish country and doesn't understand that other people might have different ideas, different agendas, different approaches.
Vladimir Putin has made his concerns known repeatedly, calling NATO absorption of Russia's neighbors Georgia and Ukraine red lines. U.S. support for the independence of Kosovo was another issue of contention. If the West can redraw European boundaries against the wishes of Russia and its ally Serbia, then Russia argues it can redraw boundaries too. Viktor Kremenyuk says the U.S. was also unduly provocative in the way it set up anti-missile defenses in Russia's backyard.
They do not trust that this effort undertaken by the U.S. in Europe is against Iran or against the terrorist launches. They still think that this is against Russia. Why? What is the reason that instead of inviting both nations to cooperate closely, they fight each other on that?
It's unclear what the aftershocks of Russia's recent actions in Georgia will be. As Rose Gottmuller notes, Russia's friends and neighbors like Belarus and Kazakhstan have been noticeably silent about the attack on another former Soviet state.
All of them are in a stupor because they don't know what to say. They don't want to speak out and support Russia. But on the other hand, they don't want to come out and oppose Russia.
Washington's threats of isolating Russia are widely discussed here, but the Kremlin has leverage it can use. It is Europe's key supplier of energy. And analysts say if the West turns away from Russia, Russia has options. It can turn east to the new emerging powers like India and China. Anne Garrels, NPR News, Moscow.
Coming up, the far side of the Beijing Olympics. This is Foreign Dispatch. I'm Douglas Roberts. Sure, there's the thrill of victory and the agony of defeat, but the Beijing Olympics have also inspired a small handful of Chinese to perform bizarre feats. You may have heard reports about government-selected cheerleaders in matching uniforms, but NPR's Anthony Kuhn would like to introduce you to some Olympic fans who are definitely not in the official game plan.
So what is it about 58-year-old acupuncturist Wei Shengchu that attracts crowds on the Olympic green? Maybe it's his Elton John-style rhinestone glasses, or his greasy curls like 1980s vintage Michael Jackson. Or maybe it's the 205 needles stuck in his head, each one with a tiny national flag on it, like an S&M version of the United Nations. Wei explains that this is actually good for him.
I'm a beautician. Putting these needles in your head makes your hair blacker. It can turn white hair black. It can stop it from falling out. It improves the hair's quality.
But Wei's not doing this just for looks. He's going for the gold, too.
The Olympics are like an invisible force. They've drawn me here to the Games. On July 31st, I stuck 2008 needles in my head. I've done it 5 times altogether. I've applied to the Guinness Book of World Records.
Most of these Olympic zealots offer similar explanations for what they're doing. The Beijing Olympics, they say, are a once-in-a-lifetime event, which fills them with pride and a burning desire to participate, to express and exhibit themselves. Across town, Liu Ming is hanging out at the shop where he got his Olympic tattoos. He's got the characters for Beijing tattooed around his nose and mouth, Beijing 2008 on his forehead, and the 5 Olympic mascots around his neck. Liu describes himself as a businessman. He says the Beijing Olympics are too important to be viewed calmly and coolly. Not only will I remember this event for the rest of my life, he says, but so will my son and grandson, because I can't change my face now. It's not like other people who paint it on and then wipe it off after the Olympics. Tattoos of the Great Wall and Tiananmen Square adorn his face and body. In case China holds some other historic event, he's got a little space left for tattoos on his kneecaps. Down the street from the National Stadium, Sun Dingguo does a little rap on the sidewalk. His hair is sculpted into 5 colored rings. Last year, Sun left his home near Shanghai and pedaled through 45 cities in 11 months, sleeping in his tricycle rickshaw and living off the generosity of strangers.
People from all over the nation supported me. They contributed money, blankets, water, fruit, painkillers, and cold medicine. I was very moved.
Sun's pilgrimage ended at the fence outside the Olympic Green. He has no money for tickets.
I can't say it's all been fun. I've endured colds and toothaches. I've been interviewed countless times, but nobody knows the suffering I've been through.
Sun sets off down the street with some fellow pilgrims. But first, he makes a promise. See you in London in 2012. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Beijing.
For more international coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Douglas Roberts.